Since January this year, we've been extremely fortunate in having Michael Lambeck attached to our department as the school's first visiting centennial professor of anthropology. And in introducing Michael's lecture today, I'd like to start on a rather personal note. As many of you know, we've had all sorts of problems with illnesses and the death of a close colleague in the department over the last few months, and it's been rather a difficult time. Michael has provided a consistently reassuring and sympathetic presence in the department. He's proved willing, well beyond the call of duty, to take on teaching assignments at the very last moment. And I think we've all greatly appreciated the way in which he and his wife, Jackie Solway, have been prepared to participate in the life of the department and add stimulus to our regular departmental seminars. So what I'm trying to say is that this is one particular visiting professor that we all hope will visit lots more times. Michael Lambeck was originally trained in anthropology at McGill and then took his PhD from the University of Michigan. Apart from in Britain, he's also taught in the United States and in Canada, where he currently holds a chair in the University of Toronto. He's done extensive field work in the Comoro Islands and in northern Madagascar. And his publications cover the most extraordinarily breathtaking range. He's written, for example, key publications on the anthropology of religion, in particular on the relationship between Islam and the indigenous animistic religions that Islam has often come to dominate in many parts of the world, on spirit possession and ethno-medicine, on gender relations and on concepts of the self and the person, and on culture theory and ethnographic writing. Human Spirits, which was published in 1981, and Knowledge and Practice in Mayotte, which was published in 1992, are widely regarded as two of the most important anthropological contributions to the study of spirit possession, and have done a great deal to revolutionize our understanding of trance states and their social implications. But Lambeck has also been a pioneer of an innovative style of ethnographic writing, through which he's explored the relationship between the local and the global, and through which he's powerfully demonstrated the significance of local-level anthropological studies for the understanding of macro processes. Despite the complexity of many of the issues he's tackled in his work, one of the hallmarks of it is the lucidity and accessibility of his thinking. And it's not surprising that he's attracted not only an audience of general anthropologists, but also an audience amongst people from many other disciplines. In this evening's lecture, he picks up on a theme that has long been a preoccupation with philosophers, and he's going to talk to us with the title Mind and Body, Some Anthropological Interventions in a Long Conversation. Michael.
Thanks very much, Johnny. If I can just make one small correction to what you said, I don't hold the chair at the University of Toronto, and in fact, I wish my chair could have heard everything else you said. Let me begin with a statement attributed to the Buddha. I have not elucidated that the soul and the body are identical. I have not elucidated that the soul is one thing and the body another. It is with some trepidation that I enter the long conversation on mind and body, a conversation that has included many strong and subtle positions that I cannot take into account here. Hence, I would like to assure you that this lecture is largely an exercise in anthropological ground clearing. I have no pretensions about resolving debates between monism and dualism. I take these debates to be constitutive of our philosophical tradition, rather than assuming that one position must be foundational and the other's wrong. I start with the philosophical problems, not the proffered solutions, of our tradition in order to extend the horizons of these debates to include the philosophical conversations, explicit and implicit, of other societies. It is my suspicion that both monistic and dualistic experiences are inherent in the human condition, and hence that mind-body, and perhaps even monism-dualism, are oppositions, like nature-culture and male-female, which all cultures, hence all anthropologists, must encounter. In sum, my position is very much like the famous wit who claimed that there are two kinds of thinkers in the world, those who divide the world into two and those who do not. To raise this paradox is perhaps already to take sides or to reveal my position, but less charitable people might describe it as having my cake and eating it too. Since the reflections that follow are ethnographic in inspiration, it may help to provide some background. Much of my fieldwork has been concerned with spirit possession as I encountered it among Malagasy speakers on the French-controlled island of Mayotte and more recently among Sakalava in northwest Madagascar. Spirit possession has to do with intimate relationships that in Malagasy understanding, particular spirits engage in with human hosts. At some times, while the host is in a state of dissociation, the spirit speaks and acts through the host's body, temporarily taking it over in a manner that one spirit medium who was seeking to find the means to make me understand described as a coup d'etat. But between such moments of manifest possession, a long-term relationship between host and spirit continues to be recognized and is marked by such things as the attribution of particular dreams or illnesses to the spirit and by particular actions, notably adherence to specific taboos on the part of the host. Ongoing social obligations are acknowledged between host and spirit and with other parties. So it's a social relationship. Spirit possession is widespread across not only Africa, but most of the globe, although the Malagasy are perhaps at one end of a continuum in emphasizing the distinctiveness of host and spirit as discrete, alternate voices and persons. Spirit possession is a complex phenomenon, integrally related to many other aspects of society and culture in Mayotte and Madagascar, and it's of great interest to local people themselves. Much intellectual, creative, and emotional energy, in fact, is invested in it and generated by it. But spirit possession is also, I think, intrinsically interesting. It raises and addresses questions that are provocative for all of us as human beings. Questions pertaining to such things as the sources of human agency and the relationship between action and passion, or autonomy and connection in selfhood. One of the questions it inevitably touches on has to do with relationships between mind and body. The body is currently a topic of great interest, but it is anthropologically relevant only in its relationship to other significant categories, body and person, body and mind, body and memory, and so on. Anything less is simply biology. I lost my place. In question are first the relations through which the body helps constitute, express, and ground such things as experience, meaning, identity, value, vitality, continuity, transformation, relationship, agency, and intentionality. And second, how these relations are configured in local thought, including naturally our own. We tend sometimes to suggest that mind-body dualism is peculiarly Western, and that we can turn to other cultures for the solution of our mind-body problem. It is my contention that body-mind or body-person distinctions are widespread and probably universal. Obviously, however, they need not take the same form, divide the terrain in the same manner, nor reach the same proportions or significance as the Cartesian version. My argument is that mind-body dualism is at once everywhere transcended in practice, yet everywhere present in some form or other in thought. In other words, we have to attend to body and mind in body, which I call embodiment, and also to body and mind in mind, which I will refer to as reason or imagination. I note in passing that this distinction may be a way to characterize the shift of emphasis between the phenomenologists, like Chordis or Jackson, who were interested in what they call mindful bodies, and the cognitivists like Lakoff and Johnson, who were interested in embodied minds. Now, whether these propositions that mind-body dualism is at once everywhere transcended in practice and yet everywhere present in some form or other in thought prove true or not, I believe they provide an interesting space for comparative work. They alert us to the fact that in making cross-cultural comparisons, we ought not to be comparing embodied practice in one society with concepts or theories in another, but practice with practice and thought with thought, or moving up a level of abstraction, their suitably historicized mutual constitution and interrelationships in the societies in question. Moreover, insofar as the mind-body contrasts that we find in different societies do not map directly onto one another, but leave problems of translation, these discrepancies should themselves open up new avenues for investigation. More generally, I hope to remind you that philosophy supplies interesting questions for anthropological investigation. And if anthropology can intervene in philosophical conversation, that is surely to the good as well. Such intervention was a matter of course for writers such as Durkheim and Levi-Strauss. It is all the more critical today that we contribute to the task of bringing cultural difference to the attention of philosophy, doing so, though, without advocating a simplistic cultural relativism. At the same time, philosophy can help reduce anthropologists' naivete and both refine and expand the questions we ask of our material. Together, we ought to be able to move beyond both ethnographic particularism and academic philosophy's arguably ethnocentric embeddedness in Western concepts. Despite the long-standing existence of Asian philosophies and the recent emergence of a vigorous professional African philosophy, the questions, can there be a transcultural or pluralist philosophy, not to speak of a global one, and if so, what it or they would look like, have hardly begun to be addressed. So I'm going to begin now with the conceptual side, with body and mind in mind. In a recent article on taboo as cultural practice, with reference to Mayotte and Madagascar, I attempted to demonstrate a dialectic... Sorry, I've been asked to slow down.
Okay.
Not uncommon feature of my audiences, request from my audiences. In a recent article on taboo as cultural practice, with reference to Mayotte and Madagascar, I attempted to demonstrate a dialectic of embodiment and objectification, in which the body serves to substantiate and legitimate certain cultural ideals, identities, and relationships. I congratulated myself for showing how taboos, identifiable by means of both explicit objectified rules and by embodied practices, that is, such things as avoiding certain foods or sexual engagements, as well as the visceral reactions to their violation, such things as nausea, rashes, and so on, that these transcended the mind-body opposition. But by the time I had completed this paper, I was disconcerted to realize that my analysis had in fact proceeded by means of a discussion of similar oppositions salient among the speakers of Kibushi, the dialect of northern Madagascar, Malagasy that I was working in. Thus, although spirit possession is a highly embodied cultural phenomenon, it is equally grounded in a conceptual distinction, and quite a radical one at that, between particular minds and bodies. Simply put, and oversimply glossed, possession is constituted by the occupation of one body, or nengen in Malagasy, by more than one person, ulu, or mind, rohu, or fangahi. People there thus face the question, not only of what to attribute to body and what to attribute to mind, but to discriminate whose mind is at issue. In other words, I discovered that while I had attempted to deploy theoretical vehicles that would transcend Western dualisms, I was actually making use of the dualistic categories of the people I was studying. That such dualism is characteristic of the semantic area of mind-body, even if the Kibushi terms do not correspond exactly to Western ones, and in fact differ from them in interesting ways, suggests that dual or possibly multiple categories might be common or even necessary for apprehending this area of human experience. In other words, what I'm saying is that while mind and body may not be universal categories, it's striking that people seem to need more than one term to talk about the domains covered by their reference. I'm not making the strong cognitivist claim that the inferences people make distinguishing what pertains to mind and what pertains to body will be the same everywhere. Research on this question by Bloch and Astuti and others is underway. What I'm saying is that what we call the mind-body problem, at its most general level, whether a valid distinction can be made between the mind and the body, may be but one particular historical expression of what are universal existential conundra, rooted in the human capacity for self-reflection. I emphasize that the point of cross-cultural comparison is not to seek solutions to any reified mind-body problem, but rather to contextualize a component of Western thought, and hence to clarify its very constitution as a problem. The assumption is emphatically not that other people have solved a problem. The body is good to think with, as we know from countless studies of symbolic dualism or the work of Mary Douglas on boundaries and transgressions. Indeed, bodily registers have long been prevalent in Western European culture to represent social distinctions. Think of the very distinction we make between upper and lower classes, or the way in which these are represented by means of refinement, vulgarity, and so on. Lakoff and Johnson have gone further. They argue that the body is necessary to think with. They appear to suggest that the body, via what they call image schemata, underlies all metaphor, and that metaphor in turn underlies many of our basic concepts. For example, to speak of a moral person as upright, or a clever argument as insightful, make use of prevalent metaphors, so prevalent that they are largely unremarked. These metaphors draw upon sensory or proprioceptive aspects of our embodied condition. But studies of metaphor or bodily symbolism rarely move beyond the corporeal to examine the way the contrast between the body and something other to it, whether glossed as soul, spirit, mind, or whatever, is expressed. I suggest that some kind of mind-body dichotomy marks, draws upon, and indeed helps constitute such pervasive oppositions as those between animation and inertion, choice and necessity, consciousness and unconsciousness, and even the transcendental and the mundane, as well as providing an idiom in which to address questions of accountability. Of course, the particular ways in which the dichotomy is expressed, the kinds of relationships posited between mind and body, the places where the boundaries are drawn, and even which terms will appear on which sides of the analogies that I've just made, will vary from place to place and time over time. This is the case because, if only because, there is no single or final, exclusive, comprehensive way available for humans to comprehend the human situation. Mind and body speak to fundamental tensions of human experience, connection to and separation from others, boundaries between the subjective and the objective, the relation of concepts to objects, or reason to sensation, experiences of the voluntary and the involuntary, of morality and desire, being and becoming, male and female, the transient and the enduring, culture and nature, every opposition one can think of, life and death. Phrased as mind and body, the opposition and the concerns just listed may appear specific to Western metaphysics. However, there are roughly equivalent sets of terms, such as the kibushi, rohu, and nengen, addressing roughly similar oppositions, though not necessarily all of them at once, which are characteristic of the thought of other traditions. These terms and oppositions will not be identical to each other, any more than Plato's mind-body dualism is identical to that of Descartes. In Mayotte, the body substantiates socially significant distinctions and relationships between both kin and non-kin, manifest in the maintenance of specific taboos or the effects of ignoring them, thereby serving as a primary means to articulate personhood. So people, notions of who they are often expressed by means of the body and the reactions of the body. By contrast, individual preferences that are socially insignificant, or indeed are antisocial, are attributed in Mayotte to mind. Now this is very different from the Western picture as articulated by Durkheim, in which he says, quote, "Our sensations are essentially individual, yet we are more personal the more we are freed from our senses and able to think and act with concepts." So Durkheim associates the universal with reason and the individual with the body, whereas the ideology I heard expressed in Mayotte does something rather different. And I think that Parry makes a rather similar point for Hindus and Benares. Now, I don't mean to suggest that usage in Mayotte is fully consistent. Although the mind-body distinction is evident from spirit possession, the fact that two or more persons are thought to share the same body complicates the way the body is going to personalize. Thus, the partition of particular attributes, such as skill at dancing, or sensations, such as hunger, pain, exhaustion, or the effects of too much liquor, to one person or the other, that is, the spirit or the host, is not entirely straightforward. this, we're going to come back to this notion of liquor, but basically people in Mayotte are Muslim and they don't drink alcohol. When they're possessed by spirits, the spirits drink, are inebriated and so on, but when the spirits leave, the host is left free of any hangover. Okay. So anyway, but they're making these partitions, but it's not always entirely straightforward. Any more than we ourselves are fully clear whether to attribute these traits, like a hangover, or others, such as the emotions, to mind or to body. Although in each case, Mayotte in the West, the distinctions premised on mind and body are relative rather than absolute, the lack of identity between cultural models creates a translation problem. I want to say two things about this problem that may look contradictory to you, but that I believe are not. The first point is that the translation problem is not radical. It's possible to see that both inheritors of the Western tradition and the Malagasy speakers are addressing similar kinds of problems or issues, even if their phrasing means that they are not identical. They can be placed, in other words, within the same horizon. The second point is that translation problems may be intrinsic to the subject matter. That is to say that the very irresolution of mind-body issues within a given tradition is part and parcel of what makes full and complete translation impossible between traditions. Now, the argument that mind-body distinctions address basic dimensions of human experience has some affinities, I'm sure you will realize, with structuralism, especially with Levi-Strauss's understanding of culture or myth as the unending attempts to resolve conceptual irritations and the displacement of abstract oppositions by sets of concrete signifiers. My argument about analogy obviously owes much to him. However, I am not suggesting that the categories function in the formal way that some followers of Levi-Strauss have sought to understand binary oppositions of the left-right or hot-cold variety. The more interesting sets of terms are those that are composed not of logical oppositions like good and evil, nor of empirical contraries like life and death, but of what I want to call incommensurables. These provide genuine conundra. Mind and body, I claim, refer not to contraries or opposites, but to fundamental incommensurables in human experience. Incommensurables, by definition, are not susceptible to measurement by a common yardstick. In this way, they are radically different from binary oppositions, whose very definition in the phonological prototype that Levi-Strauss used is relational and constituted precisely by their commensurability. Commensurability, in other words, lies at the heart of what Levi-Strauss means by a structure. We can argue, for example, about what the common measure is in the case of death, whether it's cessation of breathing, whether it's heartbeat, whether it's brain waves, and we know people in different societies like Japan use a different measure from the one used, let's say, in North America. But we can do this without doubting that there is a binary distinction between life and death. Transposition of incommensurable terms into the register of the concrete does not provide a very satisfying or neat form of resolution. Moreover, what is at issue in what I'm talking about is in part the relationship between the concrete and something different from it. The field that the terms cover is inherently messy and complex. Incommensurables do not exclude each other, but by the same token, they cannot readily be mediated, since they share no common measure along which an intermediary position could be staked out. There is no place halfway between mind and body. Similarly, neither suffices, neither covers the ground alone. Water may be hot or cold, and food can be described as raw or cooked, but what could it mean to say of a living human being that they were all mind or all body? Neither body nor mind is sufficient to describe human experience, yet they are not simply additive either. Incommensurables, then, are not logical or empirical opposites. In fact, there is no single way in which their connection can be definitively and parsimoniously described. They simply fail, in Thomas Kuhn's words, to make complete contact. Mind-body is our expression for one such area of fundamental incommensurability, with no possibility for resolution. Mind is not simply the absence of body, nor body the absence of mind, though this is one coordinate along which their relationship might be explored to a degree. Some attempts to mediate the terms, some conversations, may mistakenly assume or try to establish an exclusive foundational logic. To the degree that we can be said to have a mind-body problem, it is precisely this. I mean, first, that the assumption that we can clearly establish, as Descartes may have asserted, a real distinction between two essential stable phenomena. The Second problem arises when we have attempts to establish that there are definitive relations between such discrete substances. Now, for Descartes, mind and body are non-identical, and the content of each might be described as incommensurable with one another, as some earlier readers of this paper suggested to me. But the tendency in post-Cartesian thought to emphasize the exclusive properties of each presupposes incompatibility rather than incommensurability. While attempts to characterize the boundary between them in positive and unilateral terms, whether to shore it up or to conflate or substantively mediate it, also assume commensurability. Similar pairs and sets of pairs can be found in other traditions, but there, I think, without the sense of urgency regarding precise clarification of the points of separation or connection. The urgency derives, of course, from the culture of Occidental science, with our assumptions about nature. Mind in the West presents an unstable category for science. Claims that the objects of science are all reducible to number or measure, commensurability in the most literal sense, transform the study of soul and mind into behavior. And consciousness is now said to be the frontier of neuroscience, on the BBC just the other night. In sum, the mistake of Cartesianism lies not in its dualism, not in distinguishing mind from body, but in assuming that the relationship between them is one that can be definitively and unilaterally established. The mistake lies in trying to reach conclusion. To put this in Weberian terms, it lies in trying to rationalize the boundary. In suggesting that mind and body are incommensurable, I'm extending here the understanding which Kuhn applied to successive paradigms in science and Feyerabend to distinctive art styles and societies, in fact, as studied by anthropologists. I'm moving from these comparisons between societies to outlooks and even individual sets of terms that are found within a single society or language. Hence, my point I'm making about mind and body here is premised on a larger argument about culture. Culture, I believe, does not rest exclusively on a unitary bedrock of axioms or a primary set of binary oppositions. Rather than being built entirely from logically related categories, systematic propositions or relationally constituted terms in a structural set, culture is equally constituted from incommensurables and the diverse set of practices, tropes, statements, and so on to which they give rise. These, in turn, situated in local conversations in which participants talk inevitably not only to each other but also past each other, as in fact I may be doing right now, and which in turn shape experience, although never fully systematically or conclusively. Mind and body must be located in such long, indeed interminable, conversations. Now, my argument here is heavily indebted to Bernstein's discussion of the distinction between incommensurability and both incompatibility, or logical contradiction, and incomparability. Incommensurability is often confused with incomparability, but they're not the same. The incommensurability argument claims neither that there is an overarching framework in terms of which mind and body can be measured against each other, point by point, so that contradictions could be established, nor that each is encased in a radically different framework such that no communication between them is possible. It is thus neither objectivist nor relativist. Instead, Bernstein emphasizes the open-endedness of incommensurability. Rather than ruling out comparison, it implies that the forms of comparison will be multiple and not anchored along some fixed grid. Hence, the criticism one often hears about comparing apples and oranges is entirely misplaced. We compare them all the time, every time we decide what to eat. What is invalid, however, is submitting them to a single common measure. Another illustration here would be the comparison of art styles. Just as there is no single or final axis of comparison between two styles of representing the human body, so too with thinking about the human condition by means of body and by means of mind. Hence, the lack of resolution between mind and body is not a negative thing, but in fact generative of potentially lively cultural production and debate. Indeed, the very incommensurability between mind and body suggests that both dualist and monist ideas will be produced. So I've been arguing that real incommensurables of human experience elicit the production and use of incommensurable categories. Rather than the cross-cultural evidence suggesting that the Cartesian form of conceptualizing the opposition is simply false, it suggests that it is one contingent way of thinking about an issue that does not permit a single true representation. Not only is any local formulation likely to be composed of terms incommensurable with each other, But we can expect this to be the case in any comparison of terms drawn from different cultural loci. The different ways in which the primary incommensurability is phrased may have distinctive local consequences that we will want to pursue. However, it follows from my argument that once we've passed the first round of describing particular local concepts and seeing how different they are from our own, we will nevertheless find ourselves within a common horizon of ideas, enabling multiple forms of comparison and directions for conversation. In other words, what I'm suggesting here is that cultural comparison serves to enlarge the discussion of mind and body that is carried on within any given culture or tradition. The discrepancies between some of the terms used in one tradition and those used in another, I believe, are of the same order as the discrepancies of the terms used within any given tradition. It's worth mentioning in passing a problem which my argument raises and which you may have already thought about. Namely, why, if mind and body do not emerge from a logical discrimination or a relational paradigm, they are represented by pairs of concepts rather than any number above one. The empirical question is whether the terms genuinely appear in pairs cross-culturally. Andrew Strathern offers three terms for the Melpa of Highlands, New Guinea, and suggests that we often encounter a triad of mind, spirit, and body. Among another Highlands group, the Payela, the distinction between a working active body and a stationary vegetative one is significant. Thus, it may be that the collapse of more than two into two in my presentation is simply a rhetorical product of cultural bias, a distortion produced by centuries of attempting to argue within a framework in which the terms are assumed to be commensurable. The alternative, of course, is that human experience does have something genuinely dual about it, a matter which comparative work can surely address. Now, if the roots of the mind-body dualism lie in our embodied existential condition, rather than more narrowly within human language, there is all the more reason that the terms to express it be incommensurable. Conversely, if mind-body dualism is rooted in language, I am likely to be wrong in claiming incommensurability. Here my position is doubly removed from that of Levi-Strauss, since he begins with dualism as a property of mind or language, rooted in binary oppositions, rather than of the phenomenal world, and since he then assumes, at least in some places in his work, a parallelism or consistency between the structure of language and the world of which it speaks. A compromise position would be to suggest that the terrain is transected by multiple incommensurable pairs. Indeed, I think it likely that the domain of mind will be constituted by multiple terms which arise in different historical circumstances, but which, since they are not commensurable with one another, never quite displace each other. If they were commensurable and you had one term coming in and you could compare it properly with another term and gauge which one is better, then you could get rid of the term that was lacking. But if the terms are incommensurable with one another, they're likely to be cumulative, to accumulate rather than to displace each other. So in other words, you have multiple terms. So you may have noted the Arabic origins of the Kibushi word rohu that I mentioned before, alongside the Malagasy word fangahi. And the latter term, in fact, interestingly, has been taken over by Malagasy Christians to translate Holy Spirit. So you get terms from different languages blending together or mixing in the same language. Body may be opposed to soul in some contexts and to mind in others. The foreign anthropologist who attempted to organize the English terms mind, soul, spirit, self, ego, etc., into a paradigmatic set would have a very difficult time of it, I think. And yet this is precisely what anthropologists try to do when they encounter terms in foreign languages. Okay, so I've been talking about body and mind in mind. I'm now going to turn the discussion, hopefully in a bit of a more lively fashion with some ethnographic material, and turn to the question of body and mind in body. If from the perspective of mind, body and mind are incommensurable, from the perspective of body, they are integrally related. The view that I present here, I hope, is not in contradiction to the previous discussion, but merely incommensurable with it. Bodies serve as icons, indices, and symbols of society, and also of individuals and of the relationships between them. But they are also something more. At the most basic level, in posture, adornment, and so on, but also in touching, in relative positioning, in gathering together, in coitus, in feeding and being fed, in working cooperatively, and in consuming together, and again in refusal of engagement or consumption, in the maintenance of taboos, in all of these situated practices, persons in ongoing social relationships are not simply signified, but in fact are actively constituted. Their development is simultaneously established, enacted, charted, and naturalized, celebrated, or mourned as well. If sociality is embodied, conversely, human bodily activities are culturally mediated, hence infused with mind. I would cite Geertz, Schneider, Solins, and the American school on that. At the same time, bodily action is critical to the constitution of the perceiving and thinking person. In one of his formative essays, Most derived Western notions of the person from two sources, what he called the dramatistic or performative and the jural. Unlike Most, we can take these to represent less distinct traditions, successive historical phases, or discrete types, things like status versus contract, oral versus literate, pre-modern versus modern, and so on, and see them rather as two poles of an ongoing dialectical relationship between embodiment and objectification, which is operative in any society. In saying this, I'm drawing on the model so memorably developed by Berger and Luckman a long time ago, but with greater emphasis on the embodied performative basis of what they called moments of internalization and externalization. Too often in our writing, the person and culture itself have been identified uniquely with the objectifications, especially the mental ones encoded in language. Yet to have a social identity, as Meyerfort has argued, requires embodying it in actions, putting your body where your mouth is, so to speak. Being a person requires, in Pierre Bourdieu's phrase, a feel for the game. Just quote Bourdieu for a minute here, since he's impossible to paraphrase. He says, the values given body, made body, by the hidden persuasions of an implicit pedagogy which can instill a whole cosmology through injunctions as insignificant as sit up straight or don't hold your knife in your left hand, and inscribe the most fundamental principles of the arbitrary content of a culture in seemingly innocuous details of bearing or physical and verbal manners, so putting them beyond the reach of consciousness and explicit statement. The habitus, Bourdieu tells us, is, quote, embodied history, internalized as a second nature, and so forgotten as history. At the same time, he makes a different point. This habitus that he talks about is also a locus of dispositions predisposed to generate and organize practices and representations. Now, embodiment, of course, is not simply a matter of table manners, no matter how important table manners turn out to be. Cultural rules, values, and social relations are internalized and thereby ostensibly naturalized by means of such basic things as taboos, not only about how you eat at the table, but taboos against violence and taboos against certain kinds of sexual relations, the famous incest taboos, threats to which produce queasiness and disgust, the cold feelings of fear or the warmth of shame. Following the lead of Van Gennep's book on Madagascar, I've argued for the centrality of practicing and internalizing taboos in delimiting, differentiating, and thus ultimately constituting social persons, as selected aspects of the context are alternately incorporated or repulsed. This argument has been made in an even better fashion by the late Alfred Gell, and I want to just quote him for a minute here, what he says. Quote, outside the specific acts, observances, and taboos which specify a self as myself, there is nothing for an emblem of the self to be an emblem of. And he says further, to observe a taboo is to establish an identifiable self by establishing a relationship with an external reality such that the self only comes into existence in and through this relationship. These arguments refer to the embodiment of selfhood and society. Here I want to turn to the other swing of the dialectic, the way embodied dispositions may also, as Bourdieu says, quote, generate and organize objectified representations. Or as Michael Jackson puts it, how, quote, persons actively body forth the world. Since Merleau-Ponty, from whose inspiration this position is derived, is a good deal more opaque to me than Malagasy's spirit possession, I'm going to turn to an anecdote drawn from my field notes to illustrate the point. Just have one more paragraph before I get into the field note. In arguing that embodiment entails the conjunction of mind and body, I want to resist a completely smooth picture. Embodied practices are carried out by agents who can still think contemplatively. Nothing goes without saying, in Bourdieu's phrase, forever. The relationship between conceptual objectification and embodied practices is always going to be dynamic. There's always something that escapes or exceeds what is given from either side. The body may provide objective limits to what can be embodied, and embodied performance certainly provides more than thought alone would. Yet, as my vignette will indicate, thought too pushes beyond the limits of the embodied performance, linking alternate embodiments. Okay, I want to take you now to the port city of Majunga or Madzanga in Madagascar and to a field situation in 1994. And it has to do with spirit possession, and the particular kind of spirits at issue are spirits of French or Creole sailors who were around at the pre-colonial period. And they are one of the kinds of characters that you find in spirit possession ceremonies now, in which Sakalava and Madagascar represent and quite literally re-embody their history. The sailors are neither the most common nor the most important types of spirits, but in some mediums they serve as popular diviners and consultants, characters with whom one can chat more comfortably than the complex and powerful deceased Sakalava monarchs who comprise the main spirits and who are in fact rather frightening. In 1994, I visited a male medium whom I will refer to as Ali, who has a sailor spirit among the many spirits who possess him. Through his performance, Ali brilliantly embodies the French sailor, or bodies forth his world. When possessed by the sailor, as I'm going to refer to the spirit, he switches from Malagasy to a pungent, idiomatic, properly accented French. He changes into a blue and white striped sailor's shirt and a jaunty blue hat with a red pom-pom. In contrast to the older Sakalava spirits who chew tobacco and drink rum from the bottle, the sailor chain-smokes cigarettes and drinks his rum from a glass. His bearing shifts, as does his whole demeanor. The mimetic performance engages the body of the medium, drawing upon and transforming the senses and constituting a new habitus. The bodily habitus, in turn, generates thought. A quote from my field notes here. A young man accompanied me to the medium's house, ostensibly to show me the way, but as it turned out, in order to pose his own questions. The sailor spirit lit up a cigarette and addressed my friend Richard in French. Thereafter, their conversation was largely in French. Richard indicated that he was able to follow, but his own contribution was limited to monosyllables. He would respond, "Ah oui, c'est vrai," to the sailor's various observations. I'm not sure how much he actually took in. The sailor began by remarking that we can only pray to God for what we want. He added that while religions are many, there is only one God, le bon Dieu. I should let you know that both Ali and Richard are in fact nominally Muslim, despite this Christian idiom here. Richard explained that he was having difficulty finding work on one of the small transport boats that ply the west coast of Madagascar. The sailor inquired whether he had his work papers. Then he picked up a deck of playing cards in order to perform divination. "Votre nom, monsieur," he asked politely. "Richard." "Nothing more?" "Théophile." "Ah, vous avez un joli nom." "You have a nice name," opined the sailor. He shuffled the cards, asked Richard to cut, and then laid them out in a pattern. After a few more comments and questions, he concluded, "You have luck. You think too much about your future, but one of these days work will come." After a pause, the sailor suggested, this time in Malagasy, "You have a child out of wedlock?" "No." "Well, I might, but I don't know," said Richard somewhat lamely. "You must use a condom," responded the sailor. "It's the fashion in Reunion." "Corn silk worked as a medicine for syphilis," the sailor went on, "but it won't work for AIDS." Offering us another drink of rum and another cigarette, he began reminiscing about his ostensible experiences in the good old days. "Working in the boats, you travel. I have visited Singapore and Johannesburg when I was a sailor. Single men. We know the malady." But the sailor's point was actually the radically changed implications of sexually transmitted diseases and the necessity today for proper protection against AIDS. The sailor made these observations in a droll French accent, but seriously, a little world-weary. He continued that he was young himself, because spirits, you see, remain the age at which they die, and in this case the sailor had died around the age of 35. but that he saw how young people today tend to forget the customs of their ancestors. In very Malagasy fashion now, he says, one must respect the ancestors. C'est eux qui étaient ici avant nous. It's they who were here before us. The sailor then asserted, I'm more intelligent than my medium. He explained that spirits from earlier times could never understand about AIDS and condoms. Richard then said that he'd been feeling sick. At night, he feels something moving up and down inside his body. You can't just eat anything or with anybody. Your stomach cannot support every kind of liquor. People can't drink like spirits. Nous, c'est autre chose. We drink and don't get drunk. The odor lingers, but the effects disappear. So in an aside here, I remind you here that the effect of liquor is a salient means for expressing the local distinction between the host and the spirit, hence between mind and body. But at the same time, what it illustrates for us is their connection, since the meaning imposed on the context of the drinking can offset the hangover from a Western point of view. Richard then brought the conversation back to his main concern, entreating that he might find work and that things would turn out well for him. The sailor replied that this depended on la volonté de la personne, la volonté de Dieu, the will of the person or of God. If you strive with your force, aim toward your goal, God will help you. You must not be jealous of other people. Do your own work and you can succeed with the force God has given you. Warming to his subject and broadening the argument, the sailor continued, Malagasy shouldn't think they are better than each other. They shouldn't be so competitive. He turned to me. It's not like that between Toronto and Montreal, or Paris and Marseille. That's why this country is in trouble. You young Malagasy are lucky. This is a good country. He compared it with Kenya, where people don't understand each other's languages and have to use English or Swahili. But here in Madagascar, everyone can understand each other. Note the irony that he's saying this in French. All right. Although a surprise to both of us, the lecture to Richard embedded in the consultation appeared to be a natural pronouncement emanating from the persona of the worldly spirit. Indeed, a discussion of sexually transmitted diseases could have found no more appropriate spokesperson, since, as his conversation made explicit, the sailor was someone associated with promiscuous sexual exploits himself. It is striking that this discourse was pronounced specifically by a sailor spirit rather than any other kind. At the same time, it was a highly innovative contribution. The representation of AIDS appears to emerge directly from the habitus of the sailor, the embodied condition or pre-objective giving rise spontaneously to the objectified discourse, or at least having tremendous affinity with it. In a similar vein, one can note how the embodiment of the sailor's persona enables him to speak about Madagascar, to construct the Malagasy as an object. He speaks of the nation from the perspective of a partial outsider. The sailor reflects on race, on ethnic politics, on religion, and formulates a work ethic, details I haven't got time to give you. His is a voice of modernity. Regarding religion, the Muslim spirit medium takes on the voice of Christianity from within the Sakalava idiom of possession. His ecumenical point is prefigured in his practice. The sailor's ability to objectify was also apparent in a conversation we held the year before. On that occasion, he explained how the sailor spirits were all pro-French in their politics and had helped ensure the victory of the pro-French forces in neighboring Mayotte, which at that time was in a debate about whether to seek independence or not from France. But then he said, I'm just a simple sailor and don't mix in politics. In fact, there is a wonderfully imaginative weaving of politics, positionality, and French culture in the sailor's talk. To my ear, he seemed to have the tone exactly right, and he is also extremely charming in the role, exuding a confidence and a sparkle that are absent from Ali's ordinary speech. Indeed, the sailor went on to apply his insights to the medium, saying that he, the sailor, had taught Ali some French. Ali had also been an art student in his youth. The sailor took down Ali's portfolio. As we looked over the rather mediocre drawings, the sailor said of Ali, Il n'avait pas de talent, peut-être, mais il s'amusait. He may not have had much talent, but he enjoyed himself. We see in the performance here a unity of mind and body, the sort of savoir-faire and feel for the rules of the game that Bourdieu describes, or the bodying forth that Jackson makes claims for. The spirit's speech seems intrinsically connected to the embodied comportment, emerging from the habitus established by the state of possession. Yet there are several qualifications. First, it's not trance per se, trance viewed as a specific physiological state, but meaningful possession by a particular kind of spirit, a garrulous French one that establishes the spirit's discourse. Had Ali been possessed by one of his other spirits, the politics expressed would have been of a rather different order. Second, whatever may be pre-objective vis-a-vis what is enunciated is at the same time post-objective, as it were, vis-a-vis the cultural model of the sailor that Ali embodies. What bodies forth, in other words, is in relation to what has previously been embodied, the persona of the sailor himself. Moreover, the body from which the sailor speaks is not the body that slept with prostitutes across the ports of the Indian Ocean. Third, the mimesis of alterity is not a quality of the mindful body alone. While mimesis in Plato's formulation and in arguments like Stoller's or Tausig's is opposed to contemplative or discursive reason, we see here that possession enables Ali to take a more distanciated position vis-a-vis society and the self. To put this in Weberian language, it is from the very position of enchantment that the rationalized discourse of modernity emerges. The sailor declares himself more intelligent than his medium, and in commenting on Ali's art career, engages in remarkable self-objectification. He comments reflectively on contemporary politics and religion. With the cosmopolitanism of a French sailor, he can refer with ease to the anthropologist's home in Canada. And he makes a specific and quite deliberate intervention with regard to his client's sexual practice. It is quite right that it should be the sailor spirit who propagates AIDS prevention. The knowing cosmopolitanism of the sailor contrasts with the fear and chauvinism of several of the Sakalava spirits. Yet Ali also embodies some of these spirits, and thus at times he speaks with different voices. Possessed by a spirit from an earlier epoch, I once heard him stumble playfully over the word for a cigarette lighter. Each voice then emerges from its habitus and is closely connected to it. But too great an emphasis on the smooth unfolding of embodied dispositions would be to underplay the agency, acuity, and artistry of the particular virtuoso. Also, I think, his moral practice. Now, stepping back from this case, and even from the entire subject of spirit possession, we see that it is the particular constitution of the dialectic of body and mind in practice, that is, of embodiment and objectification, and the kind of trajectories that are established by these means in particular societies that are of interest, the ways in which they shape experience, model personhood and social connection, and underpin political, moral, and therapeutic agency and institutions and their changing relations. Persons, and ultimately society itself, are the product, even as they are also the producers. But embodied personhood also always leaves open the possibility, via one cultural medium or another, for self-reflection and for grasping the implications of such possibility. Further implication would be that the dialectic of embodiment and objectification is critically implicated in the production of social difference and hierarchy, even as distinctions of gender, class, and nationality can be temporarily transcended or reversed via media such as spirit possession. The question then arises, as contemporary feminist thought well recognizes, whether and in what manner mind-body issues, problems, and practices are themselves gendered, racialized, etc. Okay, I come to my conclusion now. I've tried to clarify recent discussion by distinguishing arguments about mind and body from the perspective of mind from arguments that begin with the body. Regarding the former, I've argued that dualism ought to be understood in terms of incommensurability. Regarding the latter, I've argued that monism needs to be opened up by means of a dialectic of objectification and embodiment. In distinguishing mind and body in practice from their place in thought, I have, of course, merely been repeating the mind-body opposition at another level of abstraction. Paradox remains intact, only redescribed. My point, once again, is that the focus on practice and the focus on thought are neither mutually exclusive nor redundant, but incommensurable with one another, covering the ground in different kinds of ways. It is as misleading to try and understand thought and practice in isolation from one another as it is to attempt this with mind and body. But by the same token, it is misleading to attempt to conflate them or to imagine that one could capture them within the same structure. While the turn to practice theory has been tremendously important in transcending certain stubborn oppositions in anthropology, notably between materialist and idealist positions and between objectivist and subjectivist ones, it would be a mistake to use it to conceal or deny the ubiquity of rationalization, as understood in its most general sense as contemplative reason. To depict a pre-rationalized, seamlessly embodied world of practice, whether it be that of the Kabyle or Balinese, of Bavarian peasants, or any group of pre-colonial Africans or Melanesians, is a tremendous intellectual and literary feat, but it is also to risk a serious romanticization. Despite their convergence in practice, and occasionally in philosophy, mind and body also remain distinguishable in thought. Rationality is not only characteristic of modernity, though heightened and given precedence here. It is not simply the distinguishing feature of some great divide between the West and the rest, but fundamentally characteristic of the human condition. And I'm partial here to Gadamer's, quote, conviction that philosophy is a human experience that remains the same and that characterizes the human being as such, and that there is no progress in it, but only participation. If personhood, selfhood, and sociality impart meaning to the body, its components and substances, forces and capacities, and enable the body, following Durkheim's classical argument, to transcend itself, the reverse is true as well. Embodiment surpasses language, rules, ideal models. The performance is always more than the script. The richness of embodiment is perhaps only now being grasped and celebrated in anthropology. And yet I'm arguing that one can go too far. The very emphasis on the body risks reproducing and possibly even exaggerating the Cartesian dualism that proponents of theories of the body have set out to transcend. The task is not to reverse the values of the equation, to celebrate body at the expense of mind, though that is perhaps something that attracts desk-bound intellectuals. But rather, the task is to see them always in light of each other. In the end, it is not to transcend dualism at all, so much as to see it as endlessly rich and productive of a central dialectic in the ongoing constitution of human culture, society, and experience, and hence of anthropological theory. It's relevant in this regard to note a curious feature of current debate. Anthropologists who oppose dualism do so in order to challenge reductionist conceptions of the body, whereas philosophers who defend dualism do so in order to challenge reductionist conceptions of mind. In a sense, both have a common enemy, namely physicalism. Thus, when anthropologists advocate monism, the monism they have in mind is certainly not the monism of contemporary materialists, characteristic, for example, of much of the work in artificial intelligence. The question, however, is whether they can transcend dualism in a non-reductive way. Finally, the very success of the artificial intelligence paradigm and of neuroscience more generally suggest a possible note of historical irony regarding my own argument. 19th century anthropologists such as Tyler discovered the soul as the defining feature of primitive religion at the very moment the soul and its discourses of theology and philosophy and the discourses of theology and philosophy in which it was embedded were being displaced in Europe by the psychological sciences of memory. The concept of the soul came thereby to stand for the specifically pre-Cartesian nature of primitive thought, and hence was defined with reference to the very opposition it was claimed not to have understood. It could be that, once again, ideas that are out of use in the hegemonic disciplines get displaced onto anthropology and projected outside the West. Anthropology is notorious for seizing hold of things only at their point of vanishing. But whether or not this is to anthropology's discredit is another question. Thank you.
I'd like to call on Professor Maurice Bloch to propose a vote of thanks for Professor Lambeck's splendid and very suggestive lecture.
When I told a colleague of mine that I was going to give a vote of thanks for what you do to Gush, well, so I think I'll say it very quickly. I thought that was brilliant. I really thought that was most interesting, incredibly rich. I felt that you've done exactly what you set out to do, that is, to bring philosophy and anthropology together. I just want to think of the history of the philosophy of mind, starting at Leake and Gilbert Ryle. Talk to try to define what the concept of mind was in the way of the time. Rather, we should have a look at how human beings use language to try to make sense of their world, try to teach for them to experience infinitely more complex no way can you refute what they say or their speculation. And I think finally, taking the negative lecture, you showed us that what we should study is the attempt to make sense by human beings rather than finally look for ultimate objects. And when the people you've done this yourself in a way which joins so well the discussion that we have talked about, I really did think that it was worth it. Thank you very much.
So Michael has given us all this food for thought, and I think it's time for a drink, and we hope you'll all join us on the fifth floor for a glass of wine.